I got to get to tout malgré tout.
Graham Atwell welcoming you to the Institutional Innovation Show. Live. Live on the radio, live on the internet. Institutional Innovation, the sounds of the summer on live internet radio. Okay, what's this show all about? Well, this is the fourth broadcast we've done today. It seems like I've been talking to this microphone all day. What we've been doing is the JISC Institutional Innovation Programme has had a conference, an online conference on institutional impact today. And we've done four sessions for the conference. In the first session this morning, we did some warm-up music, woke people up, said hello to people. And then we broadcast live John Cook's keynote address on surfing the mobile wave. Excellent stuff it was too. If any of you have missed that programme this morning, missed the talk by John Cook, we've got a recording of it, which I'll be putting up on the Pontedusky website after this broadcast, and I'll give you the address for it later. The second programme, at lunchtime, we talked to two of the programme managers on the JISC Institutional Innovation Programme, asking them what they thought that projects could do to help change institutions. And later on in the afternoon, we started looking at some of the projects involved in the Institutional Innovation Programme and looked at a project around green ICT, which is calculated, if it was applied to all the higher education institutions in the UK, could save around £120 million, a significant contribution around costs, but even more an environmentally significant cost in terms of reducing the environmental footprint of computers within universities. And this is our wrap-up show tonight. And in this wrap-up show, I want to look back on some of the contributions to the Institutional Impact Conference today, but also to widen out and look at institutional innovation in other sectors. In a moment, I'm going to be talking to George Roberts, who was one of the conference organisers. But I'm going to go on to talk to Miles Berry, who is leading the open source schools in the UK, about open source software schools innovation. I'm going to be talking to Pekka Kamarainen, who is involved in a project around innovation in teachers and trainers in Europe. I'm going to be talking about Ana Garcia, about how some of these issues impact in Spanish institutions. And I'm going to be talking to Paul Bailey, who once more was one of the people at the conference today. And if I've missed out anyone, don't worry. I'm also going to be talking to someone from Leicester University. I've lost his name. David Morris from Leicester University, who's going to be talking to me about location-free working and how that can change the patterns of our institutions. So it's a fabulous show for you tonight. We're broadcasting for an hour live on internet radio. The second half of our show is also being broadcast in Second Life. There's another first for us, and I'll tell you a bit later about that Second Life broadcast. We're going to go into a break now, and I'm going to be coming back with George Roberts and asking him about his impressions about the Institutional Impact Conference.
Sur le fil.
Welcome back, and I hope you enjoyed that music. You're listening to the Institutional Innovation Show with me, your host, Graham Atwell. And I'm delighted today to say I've got George Roberts live on the line here. George, you were one of the people involved in organising the Institutional Impact Conference. What would you say is the main things which came out of it?
Hello, Graham. Good evening. The main things that came out of it for me were the opportunity to listen to the people who are working on the projects, sharing ideas with each other about working beyond the boundaries of their own projects. I listened to people be surprised that there were others working in the similar field. Oh, you're doing that? I've got to come and talk to you. That's interesting. So, yes, watching people make connections, I think, was one of the strongest.
George, just for benefit of listeners who may not know about the Institutional Innovation Programme, can you tell me the scope of some of these projects?
Wow, the Institutional Innovation Programme comprises about 43 or 44 projects in two broad phases. The Institutional Innovation Projects cover a range of activities in sort of institutional areas of concern, like management of data centers, low energy management of data centers. They are concerned with the learning, teaching, and assessment in higher education. They're concerned with location-based services, podcasting. there's quite a wide range of projects.
It certainly is. So the thing that ties them all together then is this idea of institutional change.
I think for me the idea that ties them all together is trying to understand how institutions can work with individuals in a new configuration going forward to serve the needs of the 21st century learner.
And where does the technology come into this then?
Well, technology is, if not perfectly so, getting to be ubiquitous. In almost every occupation that might be considered to be a graduate occupation these days, the use of internet technologies is either required or quite simply normalized amongst the people who work. I'll say there, but there isn't quite the right word. In any knowledge-based employment, the use of the internet is fundamental to the performance of almost every job task.
Okay, so we're not talking so much now about having projects or programs that focus on technology as such, but talking more about changes in our institutions, changes in teaching and learning resulting from that ubiquitous spread of technology.
Yes, I suppose there is always an argument about to what extent you can attribute agency to technology. Is it technology driven, or are the way that humans do things together
And your take on that, George? You're not letting me get away with that. Come on.
If I heard you right, it's not about the technology. It's about what people do, and the tools that we use have obviously some impact on us. You're going to have to get me to step back for 1 second. The shape of the artifact is influenced by the shape of the tool, and the shape of the tool that works on the artifact is influenced by the shape of the artifact. So you've got tools, technical tools that have an impact on the world, and at the same time, the world pushes back against the tools that we use. So we've got things like Facebook and social networking and the use of Twitter, for example. And I've been paying a lot of attention to the use of Twitter in British government departments. The Treasury is a big user of Twitter. The Department of Trade and Industry is a big user of Twitter. And there's government are developing policies on the use of social networking tools and the management thereof. Councils are trying to determine who and how social networking tools should be used. Should it be the marketing department that has the, the corporate communications department that has the ownership of the social networking environments? Or is it the IT department? Or is it the, if you like, rank and file civil servants who perform their daily tasks where the communication is visibly enhanced by having access to these technologies? Now, this leads to lots of questions about what the organizational voice is, who owns the organizational voice. We hear of schools sacking teachers for making comments out of hours related to their professional roles, but nonetheless bringing the profession into disrepute through whatever behaviors they might enact in online environments. So it's a hugely complicated world. But going back to my original point, you cannot be a professional, a knowledge worker in the world today without having a sophisticated knowledge of the use of online communication environments, internet tools.
Okay, I'm going with that. But then you said, I go with that. But who wouldn't?
Sorry, Grant, you got me off on a rant there.
Yeah, disagree, but I'm just pulling you back. You said today you'd seen a lot of these projects, so it's a working on technology projects related to institutional innovation, talking to each other, realizing similarities. Why do you think that's so important?
Well, traditionally research and development projects have taken place in a sort of a in silos is the word that gets used most often. Learning and teaching in history is separate from learning and teaching in physics, is separate from learning and teaching in the social sciences, and so on. Projects that take place in computer services and projects that take place in estate services are separated. For an example that I came across just last week was to do with the different funding streams that support the equality and diversity agendas and equality and diversity officers in universities, and those which support the widening participation initiatives. So you have two sort of broad areas of activity which one might think were sort of institutionally aligned in bringing about the accessible institution that delivers equality of opportunity. But accessibility is handled in one department and equality of opportunity is handled in another department, funded by different funding streams. And so this sort of lack of joined upness, if you like, is difficult. And what we are trying to encourage through the Institutional Innovation Program is for projects to look beyond the boundaries of their usual areas of practice, their usual discipline areas, and see the similarities, see the common aims and objectives of other people working in this, if you take it up to the next level, this large enterprise that is education in the world today.
Thanks very much, George. We're going to have to leave you because I've got a lineup of people coming on, and that's very much sums up what we're trying to do in this programme. I'm trying to swing through different sectors and different countries and look what's joining us up in those innovations. That's great, George. We're going to go into a musical break, and I'm going to try and come back in with Ana García from Valencia in Spain to tell us a little bit institutional innovation in Spain.
Thank you, Graham.
Okay, over to you, Dirk. Welcome back. You're listening to the Institutional Innovation Show, and I'm talking to Ana García in Spain. I think we might have a little bit of feedback on the line, but I hope it's not too bad. Ana, you're involved in changes in coaching and the way people are learning. Is that right?
Yeah, right. Question, yes. I'm in different ways, in companies and in formal learning environment systems.
And how is this happening? How is this changing?
It's changing. Okay, I'm stuck, and I need a brief summary about the history of coaching in Spain. Okay, for situations the subject.
Okay, and what have you been doing in this?
Well, in Spain, coaching is same for dissemination, but not too formally says. Only recently, since 4 years ago, has been recognized as a method mainly in the human resources field for tidiness about traditional training and for the emerging of new activities in organizations, like projects, challenges, every problem that affects to the enterprises, mainly efficiency. By the other way, in the formal learning environment systems, educational systems, vocational training, including continuous professional training, expressions like coach, mentoring, are relatively new, but their meaning is now it.
So this neither is, this is what, quite what? A big change. This is quite a big change.
Yeah, it's a big change here because it's a new method that starts here in Spain. Hmm?
Okay, and what do you think the impact of this is on teaching and learning?
Okay, I explain you, okay. For example, a recent report of the OECD, the report Talis, in relation to Spain, indicates that teachers would like to receive feedback on his or her actions and to have in space more formal what express worries, problems. Seeing of these needed practices, adaptive of coaching and mentoring, are visible in all of the subsystems of training. The more recently orientation on continuous professional development for teachers seems to appear in the sense for what concerns to his or her training of revenue with the practicum as a training in service. In the case, for example, of trainers that works with adult population are or disadvantaged groups, this demand is still diffuse, but it's very significant. It's related to new competence, special social competence. The need of support is in this case a demand that is present trainers and that receives different or very different answers according to the context of or the type of centers, the context of people, and the area in which they act. Key points very important here are job out, a program of professional initial qualification for the adult population who leaves the educational systems, new qualification of the Spanish frame of qualification in vocational training, especially in the professional frameworks of social cultural services to community analysis topics related to the subject matter. No? Of it, they are conscientious universities and institutes of education assistance, mainly courses of training of trainers. But in some, it's a field that needs formalization and develop here in Spain. Only 50% of companies use this method.
Okay, that's very interesting, because one thing which was suggested, I think, by Stephen Warburton today, or by Paul Bailey rather, is in the UK, the government is looking to bring business practices more into line with universities, as they see this one way to recession. Anna, I'm going to have to move on, I'm afraid. I've got a queue of people waiting to come on the programme. Thank you so much for talking to me. I think it's very important when we look at institutional innovation in the UK, we're looking at changes taking place in other countries as well and beginning to consider what we can mutually learn from each other. We're going to go into a musical break now. Thanks, Anna, and I hope to talk
to you
soon.
Thank you for inviting me to take part in the program.
Okay, lovely to talk to you.
Yes, bye.
Okay, Derek. Okay. Welcome back. Well, we've heard from George Roberts about today's Institutional Impact Conference in the UK. We've heard from Ana Garcia about coaching in Spain and how that's changing the way people are teaching and learning in institutions and companies. And I want to pull back to the UK now, but to look at the school sector rather than universities. And I've got on the line Miles Berry. Welcome, Miles.
Hello there, Graham.
And you're involved in something called Open Source Schools. Can you tell me something about that?
Yeah, that's right. It's a Becta-supported community of practice of teachers, technicians in UK schools who are using open source software or are interested in using open source software. It's a place online for them to share experiences, their expertise. And also we're organising a number of conferences, a number of get-togethers over the course of the project.
There's a couple of things there you said which interested me. First of all, you referred to it as a community of practice. What do you mean by that?
That's a very good question. It's That what we've found so far, or up until the start of the project, is that plenty of people are interested in using open source software, who are using open source software themselves in schools. But what we're trying to do with the project is allow them to learn from one another, to share their experiences, to help one another sort of further on along their journey, sort of step by step, as it were, sort of get inspiration from practice, from how things are working out in other schools, in other institutions.
Okay, so we've got the community of practice. Now, what is the impact of this? How we're talking today about institutional innovation, about how projects can lead to change in institutional practices. Do you think that the introduction of open source software is leading to changes in the way institutions, in this case schools, operate?
I think it's certainly leading to some changes in the way which they're using technology to enhance, enrich learning. What we're seeing with open source software is a lot of opportunities for cross-phase fertilization. So, you know, taking something as simple as Moodle as an example, which started off as a virtual learning environment for postgrad students in Australian university. A number of UK schools that saw that as such an easy way into trying out a virtual learning environment for themselves, because, you know, there's no setup cost involved. They just download the software, have a go at the thing. There's no sort of financial risk involved with piloting it, and then finding how easily that worked and how transformative that was in terms of the teaching, in terms of the learning that was happening within those pilot projects, and then spreading out throughout institutions. I think because of that sort of very low sort of hurdle to getting started with the thing and the opportunity to sort of borrow ideas from what's happening in other phases.
That's quite interesting, because we had a keynote address this morning to the Institutional Impact Conference from John Cook from London Met University, and he talked about appropriation of software, about users or teachers and learners themselves taking software, taking applications and appropriating them for their own use for teaching and learning. And I guess open source software lends itself far better to that process of appropriation than more closed environments.
Absolutely. Again, the zero cost thing is an important factor in that, and that teachers can try the stuff out for themselves at home. Children can try the stuff out for themselves at home, bring those ideas into school, start sort of slipping it under institutional radar. And it takes hold within the institution as people find that actually it does work and does provide tools, functionality, which otherwise wouldn't be within the institution's budget. What we're also seeing, though, is a number of schools or the technicians in schools taking open source projects and adapting them to fit far better to that institution's vision for teaching and learning. Something like Moodle, something like AL, which are built on very modular architectures, you have enough expertise at the school level and a gentle enough learning curve to the sort of development work for teachers, technicians to be able to start coding up modules or adapting the code that's there. I think that is something which open source brings to the party that proprietary code generally tends not to.
I think that's interesting, because George Roberts earlier, when I pushed him, started talking about the relationship between institutional change or the way we are changing in our society, and I suppose in our context, teaching and learning, and technology, and so it's a very complex relationship between the two.
Yes, yeah.
And in this case, I suppose you're talking about shaping, if you like, or what the Germans have called Gestaltung, or design of technology to fit the needs for teaching and learning within schools.
Well, it's a hand-in-hand thing, I think. And what one sees, I suspect, is a lot of sort of technological deterministic approaches of, gosh, this is cool technology, let's try this out. But then once that is sort of people do sort of implement that institution-wide or just class-wide, then they find that, okay, that has some effect on their teaching, on the learning that's happening in their classroom. But also, with the open source software, there's that chance to sort of adapt the software to fit more closely to what they want to do with the class. And, you know, I've got examples of how we've used open source software at my own school, where, you know, the stuff out of the packet wasn't doing quite what we wanted. So getting in there, hacking the source code, adapting it so it's, you know, something which was written with, as I say, postgrads in mind, is something which one can use with 10, 11-year-olds down in a primary school.
Now, Miles, I know you've got a conference coming up because I'm taking it.
Very glad to have you there. Yes.
This is your chance to give a plug for your conference.
Okay.
You want to tell our listeners about it.
20th of July at NCSL Centre for Leading and Learning up in Nottingham. We've got about 100 techies and teachers coming together. It's an unconference with a couple of keynotes, and we're very lucky to have you there for one of those, Graham. But it's, you know, taking what we're doing with the website and trying to do that face-to-face as a way of sort of taking that community practice forward to the next phase. And so we've got folks who are running sessions presenting on their successes in school, and folk who are running roundtable discussions sort of working towards, you know, interesting projects like how to get sort of MIS functionality with an open source framework there. So it should be a really exciting day. And we're interested in getting any teachers, any technicians, anybody who's got an interest in open source software to come together up in Nottingham. It's up on our website. If you go to opensourceschools.org.uk and follow the links.
Thanks very much, Miles. We're going to swing this programme on. We're going to have another musical break in a moment. We're coming back with David Morris, who I earlier said was from Leicester University. That has several people thank you for correcting me. He's actually from the University of Coventry, and he's going to be talking out a project about distributed mobile working across the campus. Thank you, Miles. Great to have you on the show.
It's been a pleasure, Graham. Thank you.
Bye. David, welcome to the programme. Where do you work?
I work at Coventry University.
And you're working, I've been told, on a programme called Location Independent Working. Can you tell me what that's about?
Yes, we have. We've been doing that, for about two and a half years now. Location Independent Working isn't about home working. It's not about flexible working as such. It's about enabling people to work wherever they happen to be. I mean, we have a slogan in it, which it's not where you are, but what you're doing that counts. So it's helping people to be able to work from a whole variety of locations. The two principal ones being on campus and at home normally, but it could be anywhere else as well.
Okay, I guess there's lots of implications to that, aren't there? There's some technical things, there's some workflow things, social things, etc. What's the kind of
and cultural and organisational things, I guess.
And I guess for the institutional innovation terms, that. So tell me what you've been doing under the project.
What we've been doing under the project is actually taking an existing scheme at the university. The history is about 7-8 years ago, the commercial arm of the university was occupying a lot of space with its own people, which could easily have been lettable. They looked at location-independent working for them, and indeed in the commercial arm, a lot of people did go on a well-supported scheme. We then decided to see whether that could extend into academic areas, where obviously the cultures are different, the jobs are different, and the considerations are quite different. So our institutional exemplar was about trying to see what the problems, issues, benefits, costs, affordances, you know, pick your own words, are of introducing a location-independent working scheme for staff based in academic departments. So it's not just lecturing staff, but also anybody who works in an academic department, for example, academic support staff, technical staff, administrative staff, and so on.
And what's the kind of issues which have emerged?
Well, I don't know, actually, interestingly, if you've seen THE this last week, where there's an article about another university which has really set itself against any thought of anything to do with location independent working by saying, well, you know, the students will take badly to it, but you know that what students want is more face to face contact. National student survey data is always quoted about that. So will the students suffer? If not everybody's on location independent working, will those who kind of stop behind on the campus suffer? Will managers like it? Will senior managers in universities go with it? And indeed, does it suit everybody, or do individuals get a bit lonely with it?
What's your findings?
Sorry? What's our findings?
Yes.
Well, we've looked at it in detail from the perspective of people trying it out on the scheme, from their colleagues, from their students, from the perspective of those who are line managing them, and from the perspective of the university itself, as well as the environmental issues, which are quite important in this as well. Yes. And pretty much what we found is, oh, and the students, of course, pretty much what we found is that there are a lot of myths in this business, that people will suffer, people will skive, people won't be available, people will be irresponsible. None of those seem to have happened. There has been some resistance from what we might call broadly middle managers, who find themselves kind of caught perhaps between having to, or feeling that they have to, control or manage a group of staff and the other groups. But students certainly haven't said that they find that they suffer. Indeed, some students have said, well, I think there's actually some advantages to me in terms of my tutor actually being available at all sorts of times when they might not have been available. Staff are actually a bit more attentive in some ways when they're on campus rather than if they're there supposedly all the time, and will go out of their way to make sure that they're available. Colleagues have said, well, you know, we found actually we're quite happy with it as well. So the downsides don't seem to have been there. The other surprising thing for us, I think, is that while people would say, well, don't people need an awful lot of support in this? Aren't they constantly going to be wanting, you know, technical support or other support? And the answer is no, that hasn't happened either. So, I mean, it's been a series of quite surprising upsides, really.
I can certainly see it from the student point of view. I mean, especially talking to work-based students, the big thing they've said to me is they want to be able to contact electronically their tutors and arrange when to see them. The only bit I wonder about is the academic culture, those sort of coffee room discussions. What happens to those?
The coffee rooms and the water coolers, yeah.
Yes, that's the bit.
Two things seem to happen to those. Firstly, that people will actually seek each other out a bit. I mean, remember, with location-independent working, doesn't mean you're never on campus. I mean, people are splitting their time, something like 60 on campus, 40 off, or 50-50, that kind of area. And there seems to be that people have a greater visibility whilst they're on the time that they're on campus and will actually seek out those opportunities to talk. The accidental ones disappear, the photocopier queue or whatever it is. The accidental ones might disappear a bit. But colleagues of people who are on location independent working scheme are not saying that they feel that's a particular problem, that they're missing opportunities for chance conversations. And students likewise. I mean, the myth of the member of staff who is always kind of being available and for chance conversations doesn't seem to be there. And as you say, there's the whole raft of students who actually find it quite handy or quite useful that their tutor is available whenever, or is potentially available whenever, rather than just having in some way to see them when on campus.
And I suppose
yes, there is a problem about the coffee room conversation, potentially, but it doesn't seem to be as great as people
Twitter comes in.
Maybe it is, and people do find strategies for coming around these things and do recognise that is an issue.
What about the technology itself? Did you do any technological development in the project?
Well, a lot of the technological development, of course, had been done with the commercial people.
Right.
It's not a particularly high technology project in that sense. I mean, we rely on existing technologies. The most critical bit is obviously some kind of computing device, whether it's a laptop or whether it's a desktop, a mobile, a smartphone. People rely quite a lot on Skype, for example, as we're doing now. The important thing seems to be, you know, helping them with the technology, realize and discussing with them in some detail what kind of technology is going to suit their particular situation and making sure that they have that. For people who are going to do quite a lot of work at that technology, for example, it means that a lot of them say, well, I want a laptop to carry it around. But we do begin to insist that they have slave screens, keyboards, and so on. The one bit of technology which we actually are very, very firm about for legal and other reasons is the chair.
Yes, the most important one, the one I would have forgotten. One more question, because we're running out of time, David. Institutional innovation, how do you think it changes the institution?
Well, obviously, it'll vary project to project. I think from a totally selfish point of view at Coventry, I mean, what we found with the LIW project is that the fact that we've had GISC funding and it's within an institutional innovation program actually allows or makes the institution take a lot more notice of it than probably it otherwise would have done. I think that's the same thing outside, externally, that because of the way that institutional innovation programs are working and the support program and the emphasis which GISC is giving to them, it gets a lot more exposure outside than it would have done if we were simply, you know, ploughing this furrow ourselves with or without some funding.
Well, thank you, David. I'd like to talk more, but we're running out of time on this part of the show. But thank you very much for that interview.
Yeah, pleasure talking to you.
Institutional Innovation Show, live internet radio, the sounds of the summer, live on the internet radio. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dave Morris. I certainly thought he had some very interesting things to say. And I'm absolutely delighted to have a studio guest here. It's not everyone by Skype. I've got my old friend Pekka Kamerainen here from Germany. Welcome, Pekka.
Thank you, Graham.
Now, Pekka's been working with me, actually, over the last year on a project looking at changes in teachers and trainers, vocational teachers and trainers, how their work is changing, how their training is changing, how even who the trainers are is changing. And, of course, one inevitable aspect of that has been the introduction of technology. Pekka, can you briefly tell me some of the things you found out in this project?
Well, let me first remind that this is an all-European project, including all 27 member states and three EFTA partners.
Wow.
And candidate countries. So quite a lot of diversity of teachers and trainers. But nevertheless, if there is something that can be seen as common ground, surely many issues of technology-enhanced learning are there. And that's why they have been so heavily discussed.
And what are some of those issues, Pekka?
Well, just to start with new learners and new learning contexts. There's a lot of buzz about digital natives, but at the same time, there is the other side of the digital divide. So the learners coming to vocational education and training, the learners coming to workplace learning, have so many backgrounds, but yet the possibility is that just think about what the concept of learning venues and learning resources may be when new media and new technologies are brought into the picture.
Okay, and what else do you find out?
Well, just thinking of then the trainers and teachers' web competencies, we have heard in this show very many promising examples and inspiring examples, yet at the same time in vocational education and in workplace learning, there's a bit of a backlog.
I think that was suggested, Pekka, in today's conference, that was an issue of digital literacy was raised as one of the issues for institutional change.
Surely, but there are other issues as well. You who are talking about open source and open educational resources tend to talk of web prosumers, producer and consumer functions merging. In our workshops, it was a bit of a refreshing air when one colleague mentioned that you don't expect every teacher to be capable to produce good textbooks, and the same goes with web content. But there is an issue how to get a good spread of good quality resources and how to make good use of them.
And I think George referred to that earlier when he was talking about open education precisely.
Yes. But then on the other side, we have the discussion of e-portfolios and personal learning environments that again has come from the institutional and establishment-driven and curriculum-driven perspective. But there are so many wider prospects of taking that up in work-related learning, validating experience-based learning. However, that should also be the case with teachers and trainers' training competencies, and there I think there's pretty much to catch up.
Okay, and you've got one more, I think, that you found out there?
Yes, surely. This has been about institutional innovation, and that if we think of trainers, where do they go on with innovations? Pretty much of our scenario discussion was rethinking the trainer's function, rethinking where they are. And if we want to push a stronger concept of lifelong learning, then at different parts of innovation processes there, we need quite a lot of facilitators.
So a vision of learning extending outside the institution?
Surely.
Yep, you want to say something briefly on that?
Yes, instead of putting teachers and trainers into boxes, we should think of partnerships, interfaces and networks. And that's why I was envying the interview you just made on the open source school. If we can get that kind of approaches to the dissemination exploitation of vet projects in Europe, we would be far ahead with institutional innovation.
Thank you so much for that, Pekka. It's great stuff. Open education beginning to move outside the institution, also including vocational education and learning as training as well. Okay, we're running short of time here. We're going to go into musical break, and I'm going to bring Paul Bailey in to sum up today's event. Welcome back to the Institutional Innovation Show. It's been a long, long day of live internet radio. And of course, as I reminded listeners at the beginning, this has been a programme to accompany a JISC Institutional Impact Conference. And I'm delighted to have one of the organisers on the line, Paul Bailey, who's going to try and sum up the day's events and tell me what he learnt from the conference. Welcome, Paul.
Hello, Graham. Thanks for inviting me along to make some comments. I think it's been a very exciting day. We had a programme around institutional impact. And what was really, really impressive, we had about 40 projects running in that program, taking a huge range of different things. But one thing that they all have in common is they're all trying to change the way that institutions do their processes, change the way that technology is changing, is influencing the culture of those organizations. So I think it was very impressive today with the number of people involved, the number of projects who input into it. And one of the concerns I always have when we fund projects in this area is just how useful they're going to be.
Yeah.
Are they going to produce anything that we can actually use at the end? And I had just so many examples of such wonderful stuff that people have come up with, such good ideas. And what we're looking at in the next phase of the work in this is to try and take some of those things that people are producing in their projects, the wonderful outcomes they're getting, and to make them much more usable so that they can actually start to take these forward. And then to look at them getting used across other projects. So the big message, I think, coming out now is that in the project, the days built into this, is the opportunities for us to join up these projects, to join up what they're doing with other institutions, to look at collaboration, to look at ideas for further take-up of what's coming out of these excellent projects.
Why do you think that doesn't happen usually, Paul? Because it doesn't happen. You know, we move from one project to the next project. What do you think the barriers are?
I think it happens where people manage to get more funding to do what they've been doing in their institution. It happens when we've had projects that are partnerships in the first place and have collaboration. The problem is, and I was talking to, I'll mention a name, Peter Robinson from Oxford yesterday about one of his projects. And Peter was saying, what's the incentive quite often for an institution to support and fund further take up of what they're doing outside of their institution? So I think unless we provide those opportunities and incentives for the sector to share what they've been doing and to promote the good work that they've done in their projects, what is the incentive? There's not a huge...
Presumably there is an incentive in wanting to drive change, in wanting to become more effective, in wanting to innovate in teaching and learning. But I agree, yeah, we have to incentivize that process. And do you think networking is one way towards that?
I think networking is one way towards that, but I think encouraging them to support other institutions and to share the lessons they've done. These are institutional innovation projects. The word institution is in there. How do we move from institution to national or even international? And looking at some of the issues, one or two little agendas that are around at the moment: learner mobility. Learner mobility across sectors. So we've heard from schools and places like that, but also learner mobility across countries.
Yeah.
How do we incentivize institutions who, you know, to look at learner mobility across different institutions? Now, they do have interest in attracting international students, and they do have interest in making sure that those students have the qualifications they need to do the courses. But absolutely. It starts on the ground. Yeah.
And you need the kind of collaboration that Pekka Kamarainen was talking about earlier, because, I mean, I know a huge amount of students who want to study in the UK, but the system is just not flexible enough and makes it very difficult for them a lot of the time at the moment. So, I mean, I guess some of that work around APEL, I think we're calling it now, Accreditation of Prior Experience and Learning, is quite important, and credit systems and, of course, advertising for that new standard. I guess all that's important for that.
Absolutely crucial. And until it's implemented on the ground in the institutions within each, you know, within the UK for a start off, it's not going to be possible to make that work across a European level.
Paul, I'm going to ask you a question, which I asked Laurie earlier. And actually, it's George Roberts who asked it, so don't curse me over it. The question to be addressed is, what's your vision of the changed institution? What does it look like? And how does your programme contribute to realising this vision?
Ah. Which programme?
That's the Institutional Innovation Programme. Yes, yeah, Paul, I know you're involved in more programmes than I am projects, but yes.
I mean, I've always had a vision for e-learning, for the technology to open up institutions. I've always seen it as an opportunity to support the individual learner. And the vision that I've always been promoting through the work I've done with the JISC is around learner mobility. It's around breaking down what might be seen as institutional barriers to allowing learners to have more mobility across the education sector. And I'm a very strong believer that collaboration leads to opportunities and leads to benefits, both economically and socially, for everybody involved. I think the more that we close things down, the more that we put up barriers, the more that we make little ghettos around institutions or organizations, that is actually all much worse for the sector. Sounds a bit socialist, doesn't it?
It does, and I'm not going to complain about that in the least, Paul. And it sounds very much like George's idea of open education, which he put forward earlier today as well. Okay, thanks, Paul. We're running out of time here. It's time, I guess, that I said goodbye to everyone. It's certainly time. I've got a very dry throat after so much broadcasting today. Thank you to all the people who've been on the programme. Thank you to you, the listeners, for listening to us. The music in this last session today has been from two bands. I think it's called Kiffon, which is a French band. I can't quite read my producer's handwriting, and I think it's Nez Funky. And the second band's been a band called Jibs, and the album's called Classic Grooves. As always, another French band. All our music is obtainable under a Creative Commons license off the Yamendo website. Very big thanks to Dirk Stierglitz, who's produced all three of today's programmes, done a fantastic job, Dirk, and he's changed my door lock in between as well when I had a broken door lock. It's been great fun today. I hope you've all enjoyed the programme. This is Graham Atwell signing out on behalf of Pontedusky. The Institutional Innovation Programme was a Pontedusky production for the JISC SSBR Institutional Innovation Project. We're delighted to have been here. That's it. Over to you, Dirk, and the signing music, and we hope to have you here back online again soon. Fond de libération de la disco, se choisit ses missionnaires. La salle la plus prestigieuse du Boogie Palace reçoit les pères fondateurs, Clo-Clo, les Bee Gees, ainsi que John Travolta. La branche armée du FLD, représentée dignement par Starsky et Hutch, assure la sécurité de cette soirée historique. C'est le grand James Brown, le Godfather en personne, qui remet à Kiffon, pantalon en pas de def, paillettes, et surtout la légendaire boule à facettes, symbole de leur alliance nouvelle. La kiffonisation est en marche. Un seul mot d'ordre: funky, paillettes et disco.